The more you rely on your computer, the more important cybersecurity becomes. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And great to have back Jesse LeGrew. He's technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology, or DOIT. He focuses on desktop and laptop security projects, and he'll be talking a little bit about security software, what's best for you, what types work best, and of course, he'll answer your other computer questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Let's talk about cybersecurity. It's constantly in the news right now. What should we be doing to protect our personal computers?
There's probably a list of a lot of things to do. The biggest things are have secure passwords. Make sure that you change your password often. That's not only for your computer, but any website that you're normally using on a day-to-day basis. So it's really best practices. How do you use your computer? How do you use the different services that you utilize on a day-to-day basis? And just to be careful where you're putting resources. There's a myriad of cloud resources out there that you can use. Know where you're storing your data. When you actually click on an end user license agreement, know what you're signing up for. There's been a lot of concern when you put your data out in the cloud, how that can be used by the cloud provider, whether you actually still retain ownership after you put it into a cloud resource. With the cloud, it's always answering a lot of those questions, but then, nuts and bolts of I have a computer, have secure passwords. I would say, don't share them with anyone because they're your passwords. Create separate user accounts for people if they need to use it. Use security software, antivirus. Make sure your firewall's turned on. And if you do use wireless at home, protect it. There's a lot of recommendations out there, and some conflicting a little bit, whether you're supposed to hide your network, how big of a password you're supposed to use. Generally, most people are using what they call WPA2 to secure their wireless and make sure you have a complicated password so no one can break in, but also change that password frequently. The passwords are really the biggest thing in there. When you can use it, and this is something that's been happening a lot recently, is utilize two-factor authentication when you can. And this multiple-factor authentication means, supplying something you know, like a password, but also using something you might have, which would be a smartphone where you might get a text message. You might be using a different authentication mechanism to get a code. But whenever you can put in multiple layers of authentication, the better protected your data is or your computer is. Whatever that might be, whether it's biometrics and you have a hi-fi setup and they're doing retinal scans, or you're just using your smartphone app to have that extra layer of security. Banks are already doing this to try and protect your data. And a lot of services have those options available. Some don't. So it's always, how can I at least block someone from getting in the front door? And then also knowing all the houses that where my data is stored. So
there we go. And, relating to that, I think David in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
I have a question in regards to Chromebook. There's a national financial commentator who recommends Chromebook for doing financial matters. You don't do anything else on it. You don't do surfing. You don't do emails, anything else, just financial matters. And he says that's very secure as far as doing financial things. I have three questions about it. First, what do you think about that? Two, would you also add an antivirus or other software to it? And three, if you install it on a laptop, which you're using with Windows 10, would that defeat the security of the Chromebook?
And that's a really great question. So I guess I'll answer the last question first. So if you're introducing any kind of the Google Suite or G Suite, as they call it, onto any other device, whether it's Mac OS or Windows, you have that additional surface area for attack. So they don't just have to attack Google. They can attack your Windows computer or your Mac computer. So reducing the amount of things that somebody can attack always helps you. With the Chromebooks themselves, they're basically a laptop with a web browser. It's very simple. It's very secure. And you also have a lot of different ways to secure your data and even wipe the device when you're done with it. And a lot of people do recommend it, not even just for finance, but for travel in general, using a Chromebook so that you can do your day-to-day web browsing or anything else you need to do. You have mechanisms for wiping that data, for securing it and encrypting that in REST. So it does make things a lot easier. Now, as far as finance, the one thing that I always, ask myself, especially if you're using a Chromebook, which can use cloud resources, is, what are the agreements that, when you say I can use Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets, how much do I own that data? How much does Google own that data? And how protected is their, environment? And some of that really does come down to your own user credentials, how you can sign into your account. Because if things are stored in the cloud, it actually, having a Chromebook doesn't matter.
Because doesn't matter, no.
You can attack it anywhere from any machine. And it's not to say that, any cloud resource is bad, but it's just an extra consideration when you do know that your data is not housed only in one place, but it can be widely accessed on the internet. There is the potential to really sign into your account from any location. So it's really protecting your account at that point.
I was thinking more of cyber thieves rather than somebody on, at the Google One monitoring what you're doing.
Yeah. And as far as, the communication back and forth, I would say overall it's very secure. And I think it can be as secure as a Windows or a Mac OS workstation. However, there's just a lot more complications and options you have for attacking even a Mac than you would for having a simplified Chromebook that really has, one or two purposes. And you're only interfacing with one or two services. And it's verified, especially from Google, that from end to end, the communication is encrypted and they take care of really the whole thing. So there are a lot of benefits for people trying to sniff your traffic and trying to get that data. Where out of the box, if you use one suite of tools, it offers a lot of good protection.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Another protection question here from Jeff in Madison. Jeff, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I use Kaspersky, have for many years, and I've noticed recently I travel a lot overseas, and it will occasionally throw up an extra pop-up, which I believe, if my memory serves correctly, it says something like safe browser or whatever, and asks if, I want to use that. It gives a limited amount of data, up to 200 megabytes for free or something, and then you pay beyond that. I'm just wondering if you're familiar with that facility in Kaspersky. Is it akin to a virtual private network, a VPN, or what is it actually doing?
And I was taking a look at this myself to find out. So I haven't used Kaspersky myself, although it's a great option out there for antivirus and a lot of other suites of tools. The safe browser is really there to detect bad behavior on websites that you visit. So it's taking a look at the locations where you're browsing the web to determine whether there's any malicious material on the web pages that might try to, phish. They might try to get you to give it data that otherwise you wouldn't, whether it would be user name, password, etc. But there's also a lot of these features that are even built into other browsers or other anti-malware programs. So I wasn't able to find a whole lot about the safe browser. It's an option that might give you extra protection, but there actually might be other protection mechanisms out there that actually could be free. I know there are options built into Safari for Mac OS. There are options built into Internet Explorer or Edge for Windows that you can turn on. And there's actually a myriad of tools you can even download for free that also help with that. So it could help. I think there are other options as well, but it's really just in case if you go to that bad website, it tries to block anything that you might click on. Make sure that you don't or can't click on it that might inadvertently do something.
Oh, there you go. Thanks for calling. Chris on Facebook wonders about security recommendations for Apple computers and iOS devices.
And for, we'll start with kind of the I guess, the Mac OS first, even though they're both iOS. With any, like any computer, you know, they're made by people. The more fully featured the software suite is, the more vulnerable it is to attack, just because you have multiple points of reference to, you know, try to get in and break in. So for Macs, I usually recommend the very same kind of protections you'd use for a Windows machine. You know, turn on your firewall, have an antivirus or anti-malware program, have a strong password to log into your computer. And there's a lot of other options for privacy, browsing, you know, which has already come up this morning, that you'd want to do on a day-to-day basis. One thing that, you know, people feel that macOS might be just more secure and you don't necessarily need security software. Even if that were the case, one reason to actually to have security software on your computer, such as antivirus, is also to make sure that you're not spreading anything that doesn't affect your computer, but that it might affect other computers.
Sure.
So you want to, basically it's being a good steward of the cloud that we have and the Internet of Things, and, you know, make sure that at least if you do have something, it gets rid of it. But a lot of my advice would be very much the same to any Windows computer. Turn on your firewall, have an antivirus program on there. You know, if you are able to turn on safe search options that will look for phishing attempts or other spam, that's always a good idea. Much of the things we do, the computers themselves usually are fine until people start using them. as soon as you inject people into the equation, it becomes a little bit more complicated, but I would recommend the same protections. There are free options out there. For phones, it can be similar. iOS is very full-featured. I would recommend similar items. I actually haven't installed an antivirus program on my phone before. There are other third-party products out there, and there's a lot of stuff from the App Store that you can get both for your phone and for macOS if you have a laptop or a desktop.
Mary in Pewaukee up next. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I wanted to just kind of ask, I'm new to the smartphone. I have a Motorola Moto G4, and I hear you talk about firewall. I don't know anything really even about that. I'm kind of computer illiterate other than, you know, I know what I know. And any basic information that you can give me, since I'm just going on to my, like, third month of using it and learning as I go.
Okay.
And what's a firewall?
So a we'll start with the first question, or you know, kind of the basis, which, what is a firewall? So you can kind of think of it, since I already used the door earlier today, so to block anything from coming potentially in or out of your device. So we talk on, you know, all of our devices generally talk on the Internet for a variety of things, whether it's for browsing a web page, some messaging protocols just use a general Internet as well. But a firewall makes sure that at least you have that barrier in place, so no one is able to just walk into your device, look at all of your data, look at your accounts, and potentially do something malicious. So it really is just a barrier to make sure on the network, it at least makes it more difficult for someone to attack your device and get in.
How do I turn that on?
And that's a great question. So for the, in your case, you have an Android device, and even for my device, so I have an Edge, I actually haven't even looked to see what the actual default firewall is. Most of the devices have some built-in protections, but it's one thing I don't actually have a good app for it. I'd actually have to take a look. So one thing that I've done on Androids before, probably the easiest thing, and I think it goes down with the laptops and desktops, is if you don't have an application on your, if you have an application on your phone you don't need, remove it. A lot of times, you know, the applications are going to take resources, they're going to take storage space, but they also might open up opportunities for other people to get into your device or to report data that you don't want. So I'd recommend first just remove applications you don't need. It helps to simplify how your device is talking on the network, and also should make it a little bit more difficult for people to get into your device.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, today with our guest, Jesse LeGru, technical team lead with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technologies. We talk computer issues with him, zeroing in a little bit today on security software for your phone or your home computer, but other questions as well. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post your question right there. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will take a look at what the latest WikiLeaks release tells us about cybersecurity. So there's a little more cybersecurity coming your way at 2. Right now, though, if you got a question about cybersecurity, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Carrie in De Pere emailed to say she's purchased a Lenovo laptop a few months ago and has had a problem with screen flicker. She's using Windows 10. She tried uninstalling a device adapter, Intel Graphics, and uninstalled different other apps that she thought might be the culprits. However, she's still experiencing that problem. Do you have any suggestions for Carrie?
Yeah, so it looks like trying to play with the video adapter, making sure you have an updated driver is a good first step. One thing I'd probably do is actually start kind of a log of when you notice the flicker happen. So what applications do you have open? Is it a certain time of day? But basically trying to track down the behavior of your computer. It could be software. However, more likely, I actually think it might even be hardware. Okay. So sometimes cables can get crunched a little bit, and you might find that when you move your laptop a certain way, it flickers, which would also be indicative that it could be a cable issue. I would try, close every application on your laptop, have it sit there. If you see it flicker without you doing anything, without you moving it, without other apps being open, I would probably think it would be a hardware issue, especially if you move it and you notice the flicker, because depending on the laptop, a lot of those cables are in odd locations, and you might just tweak that cable in a certain way to cause it to flicker. But I'd also turn off any power saving features. Power savers can turn off your display and give you hopefully save energy, but maybe that's causing some of the disruption as well.
Sue in Sussex emailed to say she's used TurboTax for the past 5 years on her computer. How should this be handled? They use her info from the previous year each year. Is Microsoft 10 security enough?
And I would say that Windows 10, just like any machine, is secure enough as long as you kind of go by best practices again, so making sure you have a good password, antivirus. For TurboTax itself, generally a lot of those services actually store that data themselves, so they actually have all of your previous tax records from the last however many years you've been using it. If you're concerned with data stored on your Windows 10 workstation, which should work fine for using TurboTax, I would just make sure to follow the same kind of basic rules. Make sure you have a password, make sure you have antivirus, and make sure your firewall's turned on. But it should work fine with TurboTax.
Owen in Wyawega, it's your turn. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hi. In light of this whole Weeping Angel information that came out on WikiLeaks recently, I was wondering, is anybody going to come out and capitalize on the whole idea of creating spyware that people can see if anybody else has been had surveillance going on their telephones or on their televisions or any other type of electronic device that we keep in our homes that the government may be using to either broadcast information to us that might be propaganda or something that the government's doing to try to store information about things we potentially say or talk about with other people?
All right.
And my my default answer is just going to be yes. When anyone finds there's an opportunity to make something that other people are going to use and potentially even profit from it, they will.
Right.
So even in this case, when we consider, you know, looking at your network traffic, looking at how things are communicating on the internet, people are going to want that service. They might be, you know, very curious what their own devices are doing. If enough people want it and there's one person who's willing to make it, which I'm sure there's a lot of them out there, they're probably going to capitalize on that and actually develop something that's going to be usable by, you know, a variety of people around the world. Some of those may exist today. I just haven't used them personally, but I would say without a doubt, somebody's going to be developing something.
Now, what about stuff that went on prior to this WikiLeaks information about Weeping Angel coming out? What about, you know, maybe back in the past, people that potentially could have been illegally had an invasion of privacy? Is there a way for them to look back and see if there was potential breaches of their own personal privacy security with their devices?
And that's a really good question, and unfortunately it's one I actually can't answer. What I can say in general is, you know, the amount of information you're able to get forensically from any device heavily depends on that device. So let's say it's my cell phone. Well, if my cell phone does capture logs about how it's communicating to other services, I might be able to get that information from it. But if there's no tracking, no other logging, no application that's keeping track of it for me and giving me that information, I might have very, very limited capability to really get that information. Having something at the point of which you're communicating is going to give you, you know, more detail, but it's very likely, depending on the device, that you might not be able to get any information about what happened in the past, unless you have access to other services that are out there.
Do you think the FCC is going to try to take over some of the, acquisition and history of people's ability to maintain their personal privacy at this time?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
Well, like the Federal Communications Commission right now is supposed to protect our ability to broadcast publicly, correct?
Yeah.
So are they going to also be involved with the personal information that might be considered private?
Oh.
And I think, and that's a good question. I think when I think about personal information, I think about, one, it's yours, and you can, you know, we have the capability of deciding what are we going to do with it. So am I going to lock it in a safe and put it under my bed, or am I going to mail it to 10 of my closest friends? I think kind of what you do with your data in some ways really is kind of your choice. And you can decide to do with, you know, really your information, what you would want of it. So I can't see in that situation, you know, the FCC in that case getting involved. It's, you know, depending on, I guess, on what that data is. But if you think about your just personal data, it's really yours. If you decide I want to, you know, publish my social security number on the side of my house, you can do that. My guess is other people would probably tell you to stop doing it, and maybe even the government would, just for your own safety. But, you know, your data is your data.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Owen, for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Dousman has a question for you.
Yes, hi. I'm on a speakerphone. Is that okay?
You sound okay. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I on my laptop, when I'm searching out things, the arrow will all of a sudden just kind of float off to where I don't want it. And, you know, I have to go catch it again and bring it back. And I don't know why it's doing that. Can you help me with that?
Yeah, and this is actually a common problem. I've had it on just about all of my laptops that have a touchpad. So, you know, they have sensors in there that detect how you're pushing down. Sometimes that can get a little stuck. You push it down and it's, for whatever reason, it just hasn't bounced back up completely to desensitize, you know, that touch. One thing you could do, and it depends on your laptop. Do you have, what kind of manufacturer laptop do you have?
It's an Acer.
Okay. I know that there are a lot of manufacturers, and Acer probably has something on their website, ways you can calibrate your touchpad for sensitivity, which might help. You also might want to just try plugging in an external mouse just to see what happens. But every now and again, if I've had that, I've actually kind of just not roughly tapped. So I'd be careful about hitting your laptop and damaging it. But trying to get it to, you know, tapping it to try to release that pressure so it's not moving around. Basically, it thinks you're still touching it because the plastic just hasn't went back to its normal resting state. And so it's moving the cursor very slightly. And I've had that happen when I'm typing and all of a sudden the cursor moves into the middle of the screen. I haven't clicked on anything, but due to the way my hands rest on the trackpad, that can create, you know, pressure.
I've had that happen
on the trackpad.
Yeah.
So one thing I've done is I've tried to train myself never to rest my hands on the trackpad itself, because that can change it. But if you do have software that's able to change the sensitivity, it might help, so you can use it the same way. Or you might just want to tap it to get released. But if it's a well-used laptop, you know, there might not be much you can do outside of actually replacing that plastic piece. And that actually might resolve it as well. Depending on the laptop, it's not necessarily that expensive. But for an Acer, I'm not sure. For other models, I've seen them be, you know, $30 or $50. And it actually replaces the full trackpad and the sensors. But I think it just has some residual kind of touch built in. I would try to, you know, release it by tapping it lightly and see if it stops moving. But then reconfiguring it for sensitivity with any application you might have.
Okay, better than a virus, I guess.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, one thing I learned from our IT guy was when I was having trouble finding my little pointer, the arrow on the screen, he said, well, just take your mouse and go back and forth with it really quickly and the arrow gets bigger. And I didn't know that. And I've done that since then. If I just quickly can't find it, I just go back and forth really quickly and the arrow gets bigger and you can see where it is. That's something Mark Abramson, our IT guy, told me. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron. Ron, are you there? Well, let's go to Rick here, emailed to say that he has a Samsung 55, and when he tries to remove apps he doesn't want, it sends him a message that removing an app that a company installed will harm the functioning of the phone. If that's true, how can he get rid of those apps he doesn't want to use?
And I think I've had the same pop-up happen on my devices.
Mine too.
A lot of them are integrated, usually from the manufacturer or from the service provider. I haven't tried it recently on my Android phone, but it's kind of one of those items, and it always depends on the provider that you have and the manufacturer of the phone. Is it the same thing? And we'll see it in computer repairs where they have a piece of tape. If you remove that piece of tape, you void the warranty. Because you were playing with it and you shouldn't have been. And if you do, we're not going to fix it. It could be one of those items where if something does happen, even if it's completely unrelated to uninstalling that application, could they say, well, you did this, and that's probably what caused it. Maybe. Most of the time, if you ever bring your phone in, they're not looking for the applications that are on your phone, and they're probably not going to be too concerned. There are other on the Google Play Store, and this is one thing I also looked up. So, for example, on the Google Play Store, there's a firewall you can actually download with a lot of good ratings, but you can also download applications that will actually manage your apps on your phone. They could forcibly remove apps if you need to, but always, you know, could it potentially do something to your phone? The potential is there. They're trying to warn you. It may be because they just want the app on your phone, but it might actually serve a purpose. Normally in those cases, I try to research what the app is. I try to look, you know, on the internet to find out other people who have used it and to see what their experiences were. If they removed an app and it didn't break anything, okay.
Okay.
But if they did it and their phone stopped turning on, well, you know, I think that'd be a different story. So I try to use the, you know, the collective wisdom of people, you know, around the world and see what they have done with specific apps and how that applies, I guess, in your case.
Michael in Harrison, it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about my laptop.
Okay.
It's It used to connect to my wireless at home readily without any issue. Then I went to visit my brother-in-law, and I used his wireless network at his house. And it asked, while I was there, it asked if I wanted to sync to his wireless, and I did, so that I could go over there and use it whenever I'm there. But now when I'm home, it won't connect. It won't recognize my own router. Hmm. I can't get back on my own wireless network. It doesn't see it. It's like it's not there.
Hmm.
And do you have a Windows computer or a Mac OS?
Windows.
Okay. And even though I'm sure you've already tried this, have you tried, do you actually have other wireless devices that are connecting to your wireless at home?
No, I don't, unfortunately. I mean, other people come to my house and they connect, but I don't connect to my own wireless at home other than through the laptop.
Okay. But other people who do come in are able to connect to your wireless?
Yes.
Okay. You know, my first reaction is always just restarting the router just to see if there is something, you know, with the device itself that caused an issue. When you look
and
at...
To reset the router, I just I push the reset button.
I would actually just unplug the power and, let's say, for about 10 seconds and plug it back in. Okay. If you do hit the reset button... it might have some unintended consequences,
yeah,
depending on how you configured it. So, for example, if you typed in, you know, a specific network name that you'd like to use with a specific password, if you hit the reset button the right way, it will, you know, basically go back to factory defaults just when you first purchased it, and it's going to have the default network name with the default password.
Actually, that's what I use, and I have done both of these. I've unplugged it first. That didn't work, so then I hit the reset button, and that didn't work either. But I use the factory default. I've not changed that.
Okay. And so when you look on your on your laptop, they have the little wireless icon. Do you use what version of Windows do you have?
7.
Okay. Normally in the lower right-hand corner, it'll have, and it depends on your application, they'll have kind of the wireless icon that you can click on.
Yes.
When you click on that, do you see, you know, the name of the network that you're expecting?
No, I see all my neighbor's networks. So I don't see mine.
Okay. Yeah, the fact that it's actually not seeing yours is a little unusual. One thing you can do, and this will be, you know, different for different versions of Windows, but in the control panel, and you can probably get to it from that same wireless icon by right-clicking, it'll allow you to see your preferred networks and just to see if the one you're expecting is on there. You may want to completely delete that and then restart your computer and try to connect again.
Okay.
Yeah, that's worth a try for sure. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Cynthia in Middleton, we turn to you next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I'm trying to set up a GoFundMe account, which is, you need a PayPal account as well to go with that. And yeah. I am just so, I have a lot of anxiety about trying to do a PayPal so for the GoFundMe and both of them actually. So is there anything that you know about those things that you can give me warning about or tips on how to set it up so I don't get scammed?
Yeah, and I think for at least looking at the PayPal, so let's I haven't used GoFundMe, so I'm going to just assume that you do have to use PayPal. I've actually used PayPal for quite some time because it was one of the first options out there. And it's really the same kind of items you want to secure your PayPal account. So I would recommend, you know, make sure that you have a secure username and password, that only you know it. And for PayPal, it has a lot of options that you can use actually for kind of transmitting funds back and forth. If you're really concerned, because you're going to be most likely using this to take money in versus, you know, sending money out. So don't attach a credit card to it if you don't have to. Use a secure password for it. A lot of people use these services and, you know, don't have an issue. The biggest thing is, you know, when you do have an account like that, and if there is, you know, money in the account, the best ways to secure it are to make sure that people can't really break in. One thing I'm uncertain is if they do have an option for two-factor authentication for PayPal. Do you happen to have are you using a smartphone or other devices?
Well, I think there's a place where it said to sign up for Google App, and that's where I worry. I have a Samsung Android phone, so I don't know if there's what to worry about that.
Yeah, and what they'll probably do is, my guess is it's something called Google Authenticator, which is actually an application I use as well for two-factor authentication. There's a lot of services out there that do it, including banks. So the idea is that you're going to get, you know, a code that's good for about 60 seconds that you can type in addition to your normal username and password to access the service. I highly recommend using it. But also make sure that your Google account itself is protected. So use a strong username and password. But as far as Google Authenticator, it's, you know, an application that many people do use for, you know, two-factor authentication. And I highly recommend using it actually even more if you can. If you do have the option to use a password and that to get a one-time code, I would do it because it really minimizes the possibility that other people are going to be able to break into your account because then they need your phone. Too.
Yeah.
Okay. So, also, I think you were saying not to attach it. So, I just have one bank account. Should I get a separate bank account for this?
And I think it's, don't think it'd be necessary to get a separate bank account. I think if I remember when I attached mine, what they really do is they don't use the account to pull money from your account. They use it to deposit money into your account. It's a one-way transaction. And if that's still the case, because they deposit, you know, anywhere somewhere between 1 and 99 cents. They just make sure it goes through and you verify it on your statement. If it's only one way, I don't think there's any reason. If it could potentially withdraw money, you know, that's always an additional concern if somebody broke into your account. If you wanted to be extra diligent, you could make sure that you have a separate account that has, you know, $0 in it so they can't take the money out. I don't think it would be necessary.
Okay. I think there was one more thing. You were saying, so it's one of those accounts where I have a debit/credit card. So I would be using that number, I think.
Yeah, and I think overall, if you have the card attached to it, most likely it's so you can pay for services using PayPal. It's perfectly fine to do that. I mean, I do it to pay for things when I need to and deposit money into my account. It just depends on your comfort level. In my case, I'm pretty comfortable doing it. But it's also, you know, check your statements, make sure you know the money that's coming in and out of your accounts. And if you see any kind of issue, make sure you alert your bank right away. So I think it's perfectly fine to use it. I would just keep an extra eye so you know when something looks abnormal.
And good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGru, technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your personal computer and your phone with our guest, Jesse LeGru of the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have him along. Every line is filled right now. The number is 800-642-1234. But let's turn to Ron in La Crosse next. Ron, hi.
I have a question and some comments. As far as cable and video modems are concerned, if your computer is connected to one and it's not shut off but in the sleep mode, can viruses get into it? Can people kind of basically turn it on or infest it even though without turning it on?
And normally with, if you do have, so they have kind of a few different modes of sleep, actually, for computers. So I'll go with the easiest one. If you have the computer turned off, normally no one would be able to turn on your computer or get any data, you know, to or from it. There is a setting that's actually on most computers, I would say just about every computer in the last 5 years, something that they call Wake on LAN. It's an option that you can turn on or turn off for computers, but allows you to turn the computer on actually while it is sleeping or turned off, especially for, you know, corporations use it for maintenance. So that way people turn off the computer to save power, they can turn them on remotely, do what they need to do, and shut them back down again. So technologically, that is an option, but it's something you can turn off. But generally, if your computer's off and you can watch it, you know no one remotely turns it on, they're not going to be able to get your data unless they actually grab the physical computer itself.
I see. Well, I'd just like to make a couple suggestions here, too. If you don't need to do video streaming or need a lot of bits per second, megabytes per second, dial-up modem is probably a very secure a hardware approach to, you know, cybersecurity, because it's not on all the time like a DSL or cable modem.
Yep, and that's an extremely good suggestion, and actually for even compliance environments using what they call POTS, plain old telephone service, is actually a great option. And I think even for people who use cable modems, and I was just thinking about the WikiLeaks stuff people were mentioning this morning, that, you know, having a switch to turn off your internet when you're not using it or other devices that could be internet connected doesn't seem like a bad thing anymore, because the internet's kind of a scary place.
Yeah, and I also like to mention that I thought I may have had software viruses on my Mac, and what I found out, the reason I was getting the rotating beach ball so much, it was a hardware problem. I had my Mac Mini for 5 years, and the mechanical hard drive had pretty much worn out from use, and I had it replaced with a solid-state hard drive, and now it runs a lot smoother and better.
Yeah. Yeah, another good point. Thanks, Ron. Mm-hmm. Yeah, appreciate the call. Joanne and Madison up next. Joanne, hi.
Hi, good day. So I've got a PC with a wired router, and some time ago I started having trouble connecting to the internet, but really it's gotten worse. And I used to leave my email open, my browser open, just for convenience, and I noticed that that made the problem worse. So I get these weird error messages. Sometimes it's, we can't log on to yahoo.com or even google.com sometimes because we can't find it. It doesn't seem to exist, which seems patently ridiculous to me. But other times I get an error message that indicates your connection has been interrupted. So it seems like maybe I've been hijacked or something. I don't know what's going on. The way that I get around it is I have C Cleaner, and I clean when I first turn the computer on, and then I open up Google Chrome, which is my browser, and if it gives me the error message, I close it out, clean again, turn off the computer, shut it down, and do that again. And as I say, the longer my browser has been open, especially if my email is open, the more likely I need to leave it off for a while and come back to it or turn it on and off 3 or 4 times. And it's very frustrating, and I'm really puzzled by it, and I'm not sure what to do.
And it sounds like you have a few steps that are actually working for you, which actually makes me think there's probably something on your computer that's running that might be the cause. And with web browsers, there's generally a lot of items. You install a piece of software and it adds a toolbar. You install a different piece of software and it just comes with a toolbar by default. It's usually one of the items that I even find myself, I click through very quickly and, oh, there's a checkbox I should have unchecked. And I get different toolbars, like the Ask toolbar is one of them that comes with a lot of software. CCleaner is actually a great application. I would recommend taking a look at, there are a lot of programs. I would say Super Anti-Spyware. It's a completely free application. You can download it. The name doesn't sound like it's a productive utility, but Super Anti-Spyware is a great utility to run. It will find, you know, similar items that could be, you know, hijacked in your browser or running on your computer. There are other applications as well. I used to do, you know, remove viruses from computers. Generally, I use 6 to 10 tools, which isn't great, but when you look at, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming out. Some, you know, pieces of software are really good at hitting one or two things. So I would do Super Anti-Spyware, Adaware is another great one. Run those in your computer with all the applications shut off. If you can, I would actually run it in safe mode. Safe mode is something when your computer starts up, you can hit F8 right before the Windows logo screen pops up, and it allows you to actually go to the safe mode where really nothing's running. It also increases the likelihood that you're going to be able to remove anything that's on your system because it's not running. So I recommend doing those in safe mode. Hopefully that will clear things up, but if you don't already have one, I would take a look and get an antivirus program. There are a lot of free ones on the internet. Avast was one that was highly rated, but there's a ton of them out there. Windows, depending on your version, also comes with Windows Defender. But I would recommend running CCleaner and another application like Super Anti-Spyware, because they'll find different things, in safe mode. And then turn your computer back on, and hopefully things are going to be cleaner. And if you get it off, hopefully it won't reinfect, and kind of go from there.
Okay, sounds great. I've got a quick follow-up question. How would I find stuff? Because I know I'm guilty of clicking when I should not have. I've even caught myself. How do I know how to go through and get rid of that junk that I didn't mean to put on my computer?
At least for the times when I've seen it, one, you can remove the offending program. It usually removes what's added. But in this case, like the Ask toolbar, usually it still shows up in computers and programs in Control Panel that you can actually like add or remove programs. Normally it still shows up there, so you can remove it separately. But you might have to remove the offending software, you know, that you actually intended, and then reinstall it. But usually it still shows up in that list, but Adaware and Super Anti-Spyware can also find that.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling, Joanne. Andrea in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I was going to find out, my PayPal, I keep getting messages on my email that it has been having deactivated, and they say you need to log into your account. I don't know if that's just a phishing email, but I also haven't logged into my PayPal for years, and I forgot my username and password. So wondering how to go about it.
So with any email, one thing I always take a look at first is if you put your mouse and don't click on the link, but hover your mouse over, and it usually tells you the address that it's going to take you to. If what it shows up kind of on that, you know, hovering feel doesn't match what you actually have in the email, there's a good chance that it's a phishing scam, and that you shouldn't click on it. The only other recommendation I'd have is actually contact PayPal. It's always easiest to go right to the source and say, yeah, I got this email. Is this something I should be concerned about? And they can help to inform you, and, you know, they're going to have the records on their side, too.
All right.
Okay, so do you recommend a phone call or just emailing them, or?
First, I would recommend if you can easily call them and find out. I think that's a great thing. It's always going to be the best way because technology can be played with in multiple ways. So calling's always probably going to be your best bet as long as you trust the phone number and who you're calling. But also check the web link on the email if it does look unusual and doesn't have PayPal.com or something else in it. If it has a number instead, it's very likely it's going to be spam.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Mary in Watertown, your turn now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I've got this issue with connecting my desktop to a wireless jetpack. Ever since I went to Windows 10 about a year ago, it connects to the jetpack the first time. And then when I put it in the sleep mode and wake it up, it might connect the second time. But then after that, it won't connect, and I have to restart it each time to get my signal. Hmm. I don't know why that happens. It seems to, the connection's good once I get it, but it's after the sleep mode that I don't consistently connect again to the jetpack.
There's a few ways you can go about doing this. One thing I normally do is for Windows, I actually do this on my Mac too. I'll turn off my wireless adapter on my computer and turn it back on to try to make it reset and then search again for the networks. Usually that works without having to restart the entire computer. And I think that'll help a little bit. It doesn't really solve the issue. It's really just a workaround. The only other thing I'd recommend is actually to look for any updated, make sure you have all your Windows updates, and also look for any updates for your wireless software, which that actually might be, you know, a problem they had in the software, and updating it is going to resolve the problem.
You mentioned turning something off without having to turn restart the computer. What was that again?
It's actually the wireless adapter that you have. Do you have a laptop or a desktop?
A desktop.
So you're going to see it normally in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, and it's going to look like the wireless bars. You will normally have the option to turn that off and turn it back on.
Oh, okay.
And if you can't do it there, it always depends on your software, so it might not be easily accessible. But I would actually look for a software update first, because usually with software updates, you also get additional functionality, which may be the option to turn it on or turn it off, because they have a lot of manufacturers out there.
That would be an update on what software?
It would be your wireless software.
All right. I'm not sure how to do that. This Jetpack just does its thing on its own, but...
And do you know what kind of wireless adapter you have that's plugged into your laptop, or is the Jetpack just directly plugged into, or your desktop?
I have a net something or other, forget what you call it. It's a wireless, it's a little plug I put into the USB.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where I'd take a look to find out updated software specifically for that adapter.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGru will be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back. Stay with us. Taking a look at your computer today with Jesse LeGru. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Jesse stops by every other month to help us with computer questions. He works in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So if you've been having some problems with your computer, or your smartphone, or your tablet, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Jesse, we have Lisa in Cottonwood Cove, Nevada online. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm traveling, and in January I was in Yuma, Arizona, and had to have the hard drive on my Dell laptop replaced, and they reinstalled Windows 8. And then about 2 weeks ago, and I'm not in Yuma anymore, after I turn on my computer, I get a error message that says I need to activate Windows. Even though Windows still works. So I took it to a local computer place in Bullhead City, Arizona, and they said that the people who installed the Windows 8 in my new hard drive did not activate it properly, so I should give them a call. And I did that, and he said, the gentleman in Yuma said, he has seen this before, that it's some sort of a virus that... I don't know, that I got on my computer that has screwed up my Windows activation, and he wants to make it all right, but the only way to do that would be to ship my computer to him, and then he would ship it back. And I was wondering if you had ever heard this before, and I do have active virus software, so why wouldn't it have picked it up?
Yeah, and the... I guess I'll go at the virus thing first. So sometimes, and I've had the experience before where, you know, if you might have one virus and you have three antivirus programs, maybe only one of them finds it. I think for something, you know, in this case, if it is a virus that's causing Windows to have problems with activation, most likely it's been around for quite some time. And even in that case, there's a high likelihood that most, if not all, antivirus programs would be able to find it. So I would normally assume in that case that your antivirus program would be able to find it. I would recommend just doing a manual full scan of your computer with that program just in case. And There's also another option if you are able to go online. There are free online virus scanners that will actually take a look at your computer. You don't have to necessarily install a program, but it kind of gives you a third-party check.
Yeah.
How do two different programs determine whether you have a virus or not?
Mm-hmm.
So I would just verify just in case. I haven't seen a virus specifically that was for Windows activation. Could a virus cause that issue? Yes. I've seen a lot of cases where that could cause a problem. Do you have, did I hear you had a Dell?
Yes.
One thing I'd recommend, they do have an option if you go to the control panel, and I would take a look here first. So if it was a virus, are you getting a pop-up from the virus, or are you getting a pop-up from Windows that's telling you your computer's not activated?
It's from Windows. It's like it just says activate Windows here, and you click it, and you're supposed to be able to do something. But even at the computer place in Bullhead City, they said they were not able to put in any kind of code. And then the guy who installed the new hard drive in the Windows 8 came on my computer remotely and said he wasn't able to do it either. But he said that Microsoft said that they've never heard of it, and that he would fix it and make it right. And I don't know. I'm kind of hesitant to ship him my computer. I'm not happy about that.
Yeah.
Yep. And right now, do you have like a black background on your computer? In the lower right, it says Windows is not activated.
Well, I just turned it on, so I'll tell you what I get. It'll take 1 second, I think. But what's weird is that but Windows does activate, because I can still go to Windows.
Oh.
Right, yeah, oh. And it's a little unusual with the Windows activation. Generally, what they'll do is you can pretty much still use it. Everything functions, at least everything I've tried when I've had the issue in the past and I've seen it. But what they will do is they'll, take over your background, where the background of your computer, which normally you can have a picture of anything, they'll make that completely black. And in the lower right, it'll just say, this might not be a legal version of Windows. You need to activate it. So that could be the issue there.
What it says now is, after I turn it on, it's a blue screen. It says activate Windows, go to PC settings to activate Windows, and then a little button that says go to PC settings.
Hmm.
And then when I do that, it flashes Windows, and then it goes into PC settings and with various options, and on the right it says activate Windows. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so with Windows, they have multiple ways of activating. One thing that I've had with Dell workstations in the past is normally you have to use Dell Media with a Dell key to install in a Dell computer. The key that you have, because most likely there's a sticker on the bottom of your computer or somewhere else that actually has a Windows activation key.
Oh, okay.
Now,
on the bottom of my computer?
Yeah, normally. And at least that's what I've seen in the past.
Okay.
And it's, in this case, it doesn't sound like it's asking you or telling you where you can enter another code. Usually, if you can do that, you're going to type in that same code you have in the sticker. Hopefully, it communicates with Windows and it activates fine. But I'd actually wonder if it's trying to activate Windows in an improper way. Which there's a lot of stuff online, and normally I would say take it to a computer repair shop, because they have two different ways of activating Windows, which is called, which are just acronyms, but what you're looking for is KMS activation. It's the activation, it talks to Microsoft and verifies that you have the license you need to, but they have
key management something or another?
Correct.
He said I don't even have that on my computer anymore.
Oh. What I would actually do is, what you might want to do is even contact Dell.
Yeah.
Because they've probably seen this quite a bit, actually, considering that, you're in this experience. I have a feeling others with a Dell machine probably have the same thing, where you might not have the sticker, and, what do you do at that point? I'd contact Dell to see... because I think they can do remote support as well. They might be able to activate your computer when the computer shop doesn't, because Windows knows you have a Dell computer. If Dell can take a look, they know you have a Dell computer, and they might have a way to activate it. Unfortunately, the only other method that I can think of from what I've seen in the past is to reinstall Windows.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Get on the phone to Dell and let's see what we can come up with. Thanks, Lisa, for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Cedarburg has a question for you. Tom, hello.
Hi. My mom and dad have a computer. It's maybe 3 years old or so. And Windows 10 keeps trying to download on it. And because the speed is so slow on my parents' computer, because for their hookup to the internet, it's through just two wires to the phone line, and then they've got two wires that come up to this, you know, to the modem, and then the modem connects to the computer. And my nephews, who know more about computers, are saying that the that the speed is too slow to support Windows 10. And I was wondering, well, what's involved in getting the speed higher, you know, to the more modern cable. What is it, the 8-wire cable or something, I believe.
Yeah, and for to increase your speed for the internet, in this case, it's going to be really asking an outside provider that does cable or DSL or other types of internet service. Unfortunately, it's heavily dependent upon where you live and what's available. There might be, for example, wireless options where otherwise cable or DSL might not be. That's really the only thing you can do in this case is to look for one of those cable, wireless, or DSL providers. It would be an extra service that you'd pay for every month to actually do that. If you did want, so at least from what I'm hearing, it sounds like Windows 10 is downloading in the background. You could always just stop that from downloading, and you could actually go somewhere else to get the update file from the internet, put it onto a flash drive, bring it back home and upgrade it. There's a few different options there. I think you can even buy media probably from Microsoft to ship to you. But if you do want faster internet, you're really going to have to see what providers are around. And honestly, I would check with your neighbors because they probably have a good indication.
Well, they've got, my parents have AT&T as their phone provider, and it actually comes through the phone wires.
And in that case, it probably sounds like it is DSL. Because usually that does go through the same wiring. You'd actually just want to contact AT&T. They could let you know what speed you currently have, and they usually have a range of options that are available. And with DSL, you only have the speed that's kind of available to you at your location, so there might still be limits there, but they could at least tell you what they provide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what you need to do. Thank you so much for calling. You can trade in, too. Open lines get you on real quick here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Noreen on Facebook has a computer connected to the internet via a DSL line. If she receives a phone call over the same line, is it possible for the person calling to sample the line in some way to pick up information about her connection or get other information from the computer?
And normally I'd say no. But I actually just found an article on the Electronic Frontier Foundation that, you know, there are possibilities of pretty much doing anything. Mm-hmm. Normally I'd say no. There's going to be no way through normal voice communication where they're going to be able to take a look at your internet traffic. So I personally wouldn't be worried about it. If there is anyone who can do that, they probably already have your data.
Drew emailed to ask if there's a recommended antivirus security application for an iPhone 6. In addition to, is a VPN a suggested application to have on your iPhone?
And I would say for VPN, I would recommend it on any network-enabled device that you have. It allows for a lot of extra security and reduces the likelihood someone's going to look at your traffic and find out what you're doing and get your data. So I always recommend VPN. It's a great thing to do, especially when traveling.
Now somebody's going to say, what is VPN?
VPN is Virtual Private Network. There are a lot of free options out there in order to use it. Some people also get these options through work. But the virtual private network basically builds a little tunnel that no one in theory should be able to take a look and actually get your data. For the iOS, for the phone security, there are a lot of applications out there that help with firewalling and for other network intrusion. I don't have anything specifically for antivirus that I would recommend. There are a lot of them actually with high ratings on the App Store, so I'd recommend looking there.
Tim in Elkhorn, thanks for calling. Hello.
Good afternoon. Glad to be on. I was printing from the screen a couple months ago, and all of a sudden the brightness on this on the computer screen got very bright, and I cannot find a function to change the brightness back to a level where I can actually see the screen again. I even asked the Geek Squad. They told me a couple things to do, but there is no brightness control anywhere that I can find. And when I try to do it on the monitor itself, all I get is bars across, and it has to be at the level where it's set currently. Is there any way I can? How do I change the brightness level so I can actually see the screen again?
There are a couple ways to do it. So right now the screen is too bright, correct?
Right, I can barely see it. It's so bright.
Okay, You have a Windows or a Macintosh computer?
I have an HP.
Okay. I would go to the control panel and to display.
And actually, I've done that.
Okay. And yours is an HP laptop, correct?
No, it's a desktop.
Oh, it's a desktop.
Right, sorry.
Let's see.
Boy, that should be easy to find.
Yeah, it should
be. That's what I thought. And I've done a search on the internet, and I talked to the Geek Squad. I went over there and talked to them, and they told me a couple places to look, and it never turns up anywhere.
What version of Windows do you have?
Windows. I'm running Windows 10.
All right. What kind of monitor do you have?
You know, it's been so long since I looked at what kind. I don't even know. It's a Westinghouse.
Okay. And normally I would say if you can find it on the computer, take a look at the brightness settings on the display itself.
And when I lower the brightness level on the screen, the monitor, I get kind of flashing horizontal lines across, and then you can't read it.
One possibility is it's actually the display, and that the display has some kind of defect. Have you tried plugging in a different external display just to see what it looks like?
No, I don't have an external display. By that, you mean the monitor itself, right?
Yeah, if you had a different monitor or if you have a different device that you can plug into your Westinghouse.
Don't know how to do that. I do have a tablet, but...
Okay. And so normally that's what I try, is try a different monitor and try a different computer. Basically, is it, you know, a hardware defect of the monitor, which is a possibility. I've actually seen that happen. Normally the opposite way, where it's completely dark or very dark, so the backlight basically fails. But for this, it almost sounds like the backlight's just turned on high and you can't change it. I'd see if, and it's going to be kind of difficult, you might be able to find a computer store that could test the monitor, where all you have to do is bring it in, they'll plug in a device, and you can kind of see what it looks like. I would probably want to try that first, since it doesn't seem...
Yeah, I think that sounds to me like the problem, for sure. I'd haul it in.
Okay, start by hauling in the monitor rather than the whole computer.
Just the monitor, yeah. And if it's the monitor, you can buy a new one right
exactly.
there.
Well, the monitor is, you know, the monitor is much older than the computer. The monitor is probably 8, 9 years old.
Yeah. Well, they fail sometimes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Dave in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello there. I just heard you talking to somebody that had an AT&T slow issue, and I have a two-wire. I regrettably tried to get U-verse, and when they actually delivered it, all they did is hook it up to my telephone wires and put a different modem in. I was very disappointed because I thought I was going to go to the fancy new the high-speed underground. They went down our street, and I figured they'd hook in there, but heck no, they just brought in my old wires, which are buried back in the 80s.
Oh.
And that's what they hooked up. They put a modem, and I get 18 megabits per second, and it's called high speed, but it's incredibly slow speed compared to the world standard nowadays. So, but it does work fine with my Macintosh. I've got a high-powered new Macintosh that would handle gigabyte speeds, but... Oh, well, that's just the dream.
Yeah, it's always a good thing to know. The limitation is always with a lot of the infrastructure that we have. So if we don't have the infrastructure to handle it, that's an important factor.
Yeah, absolutely.
To your call, and I suspect if they have AT&T wire service, they could easily just put in a modem and update at least to 18 megabits, which is not terribly slow. It's almost DSL.
There we go. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. And Tom and Rudolph will turn to you. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi. No, my name is Terry.
Oh, sorry, Terry.
But close. That's okay. I have an old Lexmark computer. I'm not a computer, a printer. And when I upgraded to Windows 10, it said the driver is not supported. And I've tried to find how to upgrade a driver. I took it into my computer place. They said buy a new printer, but my printer is great. So I don't know how to find a driver or how to get this to work.
And do you happen to know what model printer or model Lexmark printer you have?
Yes, it's the X1270.
X1270, okay.
So... You know, this is a kind of a common thing, especially with Windows upgrades. You know, Windows might not have what they call a digitally signed or compatible driver for a printer. And then kind of what do you do in that case? I can tell you what I've done in the past, which is basically I've tried to guess drivers that do work until one actually prints out a page that looks like what I've tried to print out. It's a really guess and check solution. There's no guarantee you're going to actually get a driver that works. And, you know, it's possible there's not going to be a solution. In this case, for Windows 10, if, you know, I would try a Windows 7 driver just to see if it works. It might not say this isn't compatible. I would try it anyway just to see. because you never know. Sometimes it does work. But if there are no Windows 10 drivers, there are no Windows 10 drivers. and I've had it happen before where you're at that, and that's what I've, you know, I spent hours doing it and finding a driver that kind of worked because I didn't want to buy another printer. But it might be a possibility.
Yeah.
The only other option I could recommend is depending if it's a network available printer, or you can connect it to a network, it might be a workaround. I think that might be overcomplicating it a little bit, but I would actually see if anyone's been able to get a Windows 10 workstation to work on the internet just to see what options are there. But unfortunately, in this case, I would try to possibly look into even getting another printer.
Yeah, that's, well, they're relatively inexpensive, but I can understand why you don't want to spend the money. Jesse LeGrew, thank you so much. We'll see you in a couple months, and we'll do this all over again.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Information Technology. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.